Now, the Tibetan staff seemed to apply the same methods to the reckoning of its regiments. I went to the Bodh Tomb of the Mystery and learned that strict orders were given along, originally a fort, but, by extension, nowadays any building that is the seat of an official or of a local chief of tribes, to the people all along the Sino-Tibetan border to speak of powerful troops stationed in the watch posts. Then, when I myself went to investigate on the spot, and discovered half a dozen or 10 warriors where 300 were said to have their abode, I was told that the remainder were at home. That meant that the 50 or 100 which made up the mythical 300 were but villagers who would be provided with a gun and sent to fight if the Lhasa government deemed it wise. In the meantime, the actual rulers do not appear to trust their countrymen newly liberated from the Chinese rule. Several times I asked regular soldiers why they were all men from central Tibet, and the answer was always the same: if the campers had good guns they would fire at us. On one occasion some of the regulars from Tsang told me that a few years before, when they fought against the Chinese in western Sichuan, some of the Tibetan villagers had fled away and, at night, when the Lhasa troops were camped in the conquered place, they returned with Chinese soldiers and fell on them with their swords. In view of this, when it is considered indispensable to arm the reserve soldiers who remain at home, the government supplies them only with old-pattern Tibetan or Chinese guns. Men who held them in their hands smiled when I asked the reason for it. Those from Lhasa, they said, do not wish us to be able to match their own soldiers. They know what some of us might do. The hatred of the new Lhasa masters did not seem to have reached that degree in the Zarong and Tsawarong valleys, but even though they are patiently accepted, it is easy to understand that they are not much liked. We left the hospitable farmers at dawn, and proceeded on our way along the valley. Few landscapes in the world can compete with the graceful yet majestic scenery of the new valley. We crossed large meadows strewn with rocks of different sizes and shapes, where trees of various species grew, here, isolated, there in clusters, yonder forming groves, as if they had been trimmed and planted where they stood by some artistic gardener. An air of gentle mystery, of pristine purity, spread over everything. I seemed to be walking across a picture out of an old book of legends, and would not have been very startled had I suddenly surprised some elves seated on sun rays, or come upon the enchanted palace of the Sleeping Beauty. The weather continued to be glorious, and, strangely enough, though shallow ponds and rivulets were frozen, the night was not really cold. The queer glimmers of hidden fires that had puzzled us in the Kakapo forest reappeared in the darkest recesses of this natural park. They became so much a part of the nocturnal landscape that we did not trouble any more about them, whatever their cause may have been. Every day we met groups of pilgrims journeying toward the holy Kakapo. Villages were near enough to allow them to spend the nights in shelter. For my part, I preferred to sleep under the trees, shrouded in silence and serenity. Wild animals seemed scarce in the valley. Once, when I remained awake longer than usual, I saw a wolf passing near us. It trotted by with the busy yet calm gait of a serious gentleman going to attend to some affair of importance. Although it was well aware of our presence, it did not show the least curiosity or fear, but went its way with the utmost indifference, as if intent on affairs of its own. I have said that, when putting on my Tibetan disguise I used Chinese ink to blacken my hair. It did not prove a very fast dye. A great part of the stuff came off on the turban which I wore after the Lhasa Gyang fashion. I therefore revived the jet black color of my plaits from time to time. Needless to say, during this work my fingers got their share of dye. But this did not matter much, for the personality of the old beggar mother which I had assumed required me to be as dirty as possible, and I frequently used to rub my hands on the smoky bottom of our kettle to match the color of these of the country women folk, so ink could not be conspicuous. On one occasion when I begged in a village of the New Valley, this dye gave birth to a comical, although rather unpleasant, incident. I had gone from door to door, reciting prayers according to the custom of needy pilgrims. A good housewife called Yong Den and me inside for a meal, and poured in our bowls curd and sampa. The custom is to use one's fingers to mix them. So, forgetting all about the hair and ink business to which I had attended a few hours before, I dipped my fingers in my bowl and began to knead the flour. But what is this? It becomes black, dirty streaks appear and grow wider on the milky meal. Oh, I see. The dye on my fingers comes off. What is to be done? Yonglin, who has just glanced at me, sees the catastrophe. Comic as it is, the situation is nevertheless serious. It could provoke embarrassing questions, lead to the discovery of my identity. Eat quickly. The Lama advises in a suppressed but most imperative tone. I try. What a nasty taste. Eat, eat quickly. Urges my young companion desperately. The Nemo, hostess, is coming back to us, and shutting my eyes, I hastily swallow the contents of the bowl. We proceeded through this beautiful country toward the monastery of Dayal. Though previous meetings with Ponpos had all ended nicely for me, I had not the least desire to take willingly more chances of that kind. So, knowing that an official resided at Dayal, I had decided to pass the place at night. The thing appeared plain enough. Yet for us who did not know the region, who had no milestones as guides and who moved in a dense forest, it was rather difficult to regulate our gait in order to arrive at the monastery at the time chosen. One morning some villagers told us, "You will reach Dayal today." This was news, but how vague. Was one to make haste, or to take it leisurely so as to arrive during the day? We could not guess. The Tibetans, like most country people, except the Chinese, have no precise idea of distance. The latter can at any moment on any road tell you how many miles it is from one place to another. Out of fear of emerging from the woods in front of the Gompa before night had fallen, we spent a part of the day hidden under the trees near the river, eating and musing, with the result that, the monastery being farther than we had supposed, we tramped for a long time at night before discovering it. Through the Eden-like valley, even more romantic in the darkness, we proceeded in complete silence, straining our eyes in vain in an endeavor to discern shapes of buildings on the opposite shore of the river on which, we knew, stood the monastery. We had nearly become convinced that, having delayed too long on the way, we should not reach it before daybreak. As the time passed, my anxiety increased. I walked nervously ahead when I saw white forms, like walls, in the middle of the widening path. We had arrived near two mendongs separated by cordons and surrounded by a large number of mystic flags. We could still see no houses on the opposite bank, but I was too well acquainted with Tibet to have the least doubt that we were in front of the monastery. A few minutes later we reached the bridge spanning the river in front of the Gompu about which we had been told. We knew that we did not need to cross it, although in addition to an important track going to Dawa and other places, several bypaths existed, on the right bank of the river New, which we could have followed, but I had decided to continue on the left bank, in order to avoid the monastery completely. The night was clear, stars shone in the sky without a cloud, yet their dim light did not allow us to see far ahead. The path we had followed for many days seemed to end near a second bridge, about which I had heard nothing. Anyhow, no other passage appeared possible and we were in a great hurry to be far from the Gompa. The bridge once crossed, we found ourselves walking on stones amongst which water streamed everywhere. We pushed on for some distance, then I became convinced that we had missed the way. We went back, crossed the bridge again, and, while nearing its end, we heard a feeble noise. In no time we hid ourselves behind a wall close to the river. Then I looked around me. Heavens! We were in a small courtyard. A 10 steps away people were probably sleeping who might awaken and discover us. Taking the utmost care to avoid being heard, we went out and walked toward the mendong to look for another way. But except for the two bridges, it really seemed that there was none. We hardly knew what to think. We might have been misinformed or have misunderstood the directions that had been given to us, but we could not remain there to ponder over the matter. We must make haste to leave the vicinity of the monastery and go wherever we could, at the risk of trying to find the right way again on the morrow. If we had missed it, or even of being compelled to change our itinerary. Then Yongdan went to scout beyond the bridge which was in front of the Gompa. At length I vaguely discerned the whitish mass of the monastery outlined in a recess of the hillside. It reminded me of the Shagzam and of my last failure, and at this particular moment such a memory had nothing pleasing in it. Under the feet of the Lama the planks of the bridge made an awful noise. Then silence fell for a long time, until finally I heard the noise made by the young man in returning. It is impossible, I thought, that nobody has been awakened. Soldiers or servants will come. I awaited a shout calling the night traveler, commanding him to come forward, show himself and tell why he was roaming at that hour. I feared even worse, shots in the night, a bullet which, perchance, might hit Yongdan. The report of the scout was not encouraging. He had seen but one path leading from the shore to the Gompa. The tracks probably started from behind the buildings. Whatever it might be, we did not want to risk ourselves near the monastery. The noise made by my companion had rendered a quick flight still more urgent. We ran toward the first bridge we had crossed, passed again through the water and amongst the stones, and reached a small shrine built under a tree. There our path divided in two. We turned to the left without knowing why, climbed a steep winding path, and arrived at a village. Beyond it, higher up, we lost ourselves amongst irrigation canals and fields built terrace upon terrace. Where were we to go? Once more Yongdan put his load down beside me and started scouting. I sat on crumbling stones, fearing, each time that I moved, to slide down the slope. A cold wind arose. I shivered, crouched amongst the baggage. Suddenly a dog barked above me and continued for a long time, tiring my overstrained nerves. Was the Lama in that direction? Would he find the road? He did not come back. Several hours went by, as I could see by the radium dial of my small watch, which I consulted again and again. What had happened to him? Far away big stones began to roll down. What was that? A small landslide only, or an accident? J. In the dark, a slip caused by a shadow is enough to send the wanderer rolling down to break his neck on the rocks or be drowned in the river. I stood in readiness to go and look for the young man. He stayed too long, something bad must have happened. I went a few steps, all was darkness around me. How could I discover him? And if he came back while I was away, how frightened he would be at the sight of the loads abandoned and myself gone. And would either he or I be able in the darkness to find the place where we had left the luggage? If no one remained there, who could signal as faintly as possible to the one who came back? Prudence commanded me to stay, and my inactivity added to the anxiety which tormented me. The scout appeared at last. I had guessed right. He had fallen and been carried down with sliding stones. Happily, he had stopped on a small platform, while a boulder jumped near him and continued its course down. He was a little excited, as well he might be, after such a narrow escape, but his main thought was about the road. He had found none. The situation was critical. We could not think of remaining perched on that bare slope where we could be seen from all sides at the first gleam of dawn. We must go down. I said, if need be, as far as the Mendong in front of the Gompa. In that way, if people see us in the early morning we will not appear strange, and can pretend that we have slept at the monastery or near it. There was nothing else to do. We once more crossed the village, but the night faded as we wandered. As soon as we had reached the last house it was daybreak. It was necessary, now, to go farther down. If asked whence we were coming, we could answer quite plausibly that we were coming from the monastery. There remained only to ascertain if the path on which we were was the right one. Yongdan left me seated against the fence around a field, and, going up again to the farms, he knocked at a door. A half-awakened man opened a window of the upper story, and from him, the Lama learned that we had but to climb again to about the place where I had spent a part of the night, and keep on to another village. I quickly took up my load, and I for the third time, and Yongd for the fifth, together crossed the tiresome village. We proceeded as silently and as quickly as we could, deeming it prudent to avoid the inhabitants. As for the man of whom my son had asked his way, he could speak of but one lonely lama pilgrim, for he had not seen me. We arrived at the top of the hill, where we found several big houses. One of them looked particularly large and well built. Most likely it was the abode of one of those petty princes who, before the Lhasa government had annexed Eastern Tibet, were independent rulers, each one on his own small territory. Or it might have been that the Lhasa official lived there, and not in the monastery, as we had understood. From the we could easily see Dayal beneath us. People were already afoot. A woman appeared and I went piously round a courton, as the proper thing for a pilgrim to do at the beginning of the day. There was a crossroad here, but my young friend did not see it. He thought that my wanderings meant that I had found no path on the other side and disappeared at full speed up a road opening on his right. I followed hastily to tell him that he was turning his back to the river New, but before I could join him a man barred his way and politely, yet with an inquisitive look which turned my blood cold, asked him several questions about his country, his journey, and the Liaoi, but to my astonishment he did not look at me. Nervous, overtired by his exertion during the previous night, Yongdan answered blunderingly. I was dying of fear. We learned that we had made a mistake, and had taken the Kiamdo road, instead of that of Zogong. We retraced our steps, but now we had been seen and the villager with his suspicious look and his inquisitive questions knew which way we had gone. What a result for all the trouble we had taken during a whole night. At sunrise we saw once more Dayal Gompui all white in its nest of greenwoods. I feared the man would inform the Ponpo. I calculated the time he would take in going down to the monastery, seeing the official, saddling a horse, and for a rider to catch up with us. It could not have taken very long. Yet nobody appeared behind us. But yes, there is a peasant. He carries a bag, he is on foot. The Ponpo would not send a man after us with a load on his shoulders. He overtakes us, he is gone. The path is empty behind us. We continue our walk. A jingling of bells makes us start. A horseman approaches. I straighten my back. I do not want to faint, but I feel the blood leaving my brain, everything around me jitters and darkens. I have just the time to move to the side of the path to avoid being knocked down by the horse. The man has passed us, the tinkling grows fainter and finally ceases. We are still far from being completely reassured, but emotion and a long tramp have exhausted our strength. Below the road, cut high on the hill, a series of large natural terraces descends and steps down to the river. They, also, in the rosy light of the early morning, remind me of fairyland gardens. Autumn leaves blaze in their golden and purple tints around the dark greens of the fir trees. Strewn on the grass, sprinkled in places with a fine snow, they make a carpet such as no emperor has ever seen in his throne room. I tell Yongdan to follow me down. We quickly boil our tea and eat some sampa with a ferocious appetite. Emotions may tire me, but can never prevent me from eating or sleeping. Sleep is especially needed. And now the sun is shining and will keep us warm. We continued on our way in the afternoon and reached a hot spring. There are quite a number of them all over Tibet, but we had not yet come across any since we left Yunnan. I felt delighted at the prospect of a warm bath. A rustic basin had been built with stones for that purpose, near a rocky wall which sheltered it. I had only to wait until night to enter the water without any fear of allowing the color of my skin to be seen by occasional passers-by. Judge of my annoyance when a family of pilgrims, father, mother, and three children, came and pitched their camp next us. I had not the least doubt that they would all sit in the basin, for Tibetans are very fond of hot natural baths, and as they had not the same reasons as I for waiting until night, I would get the water in which they had already bathed. Although the spring bubbling at the bottom of it sent a continual stream through the small artificial pool which overflowed through a specially built canal, I did not like that idea at all. But, of course, all happened as I had foreseen. Yongdan, whom I told to hurry to enjoy the clean water, reported to me when he returned that his bath had been shortened by the entrance of the father and three sons into the water. I could but wait, and I waited long. The happy sensation produced by the hot water in that cold country kept the four Tibetans under its spell for more than 1 hour. Night had fallen and a cold wind promised little comfort for the moment, since on coming out of the bath I should have to dry myself in the open with my root mean square towel. Still more delay was caused by my desire to allow time for the water of the bath to be changed. But I started at last for the spring, after having been earnestly entreated by Yongden to avoid washing my face, which had now become nearly the orthodox color of a Tibetan countrywoman. A few days later, on a sunny morning, we were walking leisurely on the bank of the river when two lamas dressed in lay clothes reached us, coming up from behind. They asked about our country and many other details for a rather long time, and one of them stared at me with peculiar insistence. They said that they were in the service of the governor of Mekong and carried a message from him to the officer residing at Zogong. We both noticed the way one of them had looked at me, and, as anybody in our circumstances would have done, we began to fancy the worst. Maybe some rumors had spread after our leaving Mekong and had only recently reached the governor, who had dispatched these two to inform his colleague and order him to ascertain who we were. Previous disquieting meetings had come to a quick end, but this one left a lasting terror in its wake. Zogong, where we should know our fate, was still far away, and each day brought the same question. Were we not walking toward our doom? We reverted to our nocturnal tramps. We had become again the scared game dreaming of the hunter. One morning at dawn a party of pilgrims met us and stopped to exchange a few words. According to my custom, I continued to walk slowly ahead while Yongden was talking with the men. When he rejoined me he was more frightened than I had ever seen him. "They are people from Rewok," he said. "Who knows if they have not seen you when you went there with Thobgil. You are quite famous in that reason. Rewok is the site of a once celebrated monastery, now half ruined. I had stayed there twice during a previous journey in Tibet after having entered the Forbidden Zone through the Iron Bridge. Our fears grew. Hour by hour they became greater. At the sight of each group of men or women who happened to pass us we trembled, thinking of the catastrophe that awaited us. Truly, this way madness lay." In that mood we reached a bridge on the River New, near a big village called Parang. "Let us take a chance," I said to my companion. "On this side of the stream we run the risk of meeting old acquaintances from the province of Kham, because that is the way by which they go to Kakapo. We shall also have to cross Zogong, where these lamas have perhaps spoken about us, even if they have not been sent to catch us. Here is a bridge, as there are few in Tibet, showing that there is a trail of some importance on the other bank. The Jiamo New River flows in that direction. Let us try to reach it and we will then see what can be done." We therefore crossed the bridge and bravely climbed the trail beyond it, without knowing where it would lead us. That evening we slept at an isolated farm, and on the morrow, continuing through wild forests, we crossed the Ra Pass. We had been told at the farm that the region beyond was completely uninhabited except for a few Dokpas, who moved with their cattle along the valleys enclosed between two high ranges. Our good luck brought us on the second day near to an encampment of cowmen. They gave us some butter and sampa, but did not allow us to sleep in their hut. There were about 40 armed men assembled around it, and I guessed that they were preparing a robbing expedition, so they naturally did not wish to discuss their plans before unknown travelers. We begged from other camps nearby and were given a good deal of cheese, butter, and sampa. After a night spent in the open, we started, heavily loaded, but certain that starvation was not imminent. The country we were crossing had none of the charms of the new valley. It was colder and often barren. The trails were difficult to find. In the morning, after having set out from the Dokpaza camp, we crossed a clear river, climbed a very steep path, and then missed our way. We had already wandered about 2 hours when some sharp-eyed cowboys discovered us on the slope of the mountain. They themselves had wandered far from their camp with their cattle, and now were almost beneath us. but at a considerable distance. Their shouts arrived faint and indistinct, and at first we did not understand that they were addressed to us. By straining our ears we succeeded in catching some words. We were to turn back, and then to proceed upwards. From the Pangala, an endless descent through forests led to large rocky caves inhabited in the summer by cowmen. At that time of the year a torrent nearby supplied them with water, but it was now quite dry, so that in the absence of water we continued our way, although the shelter of these roomy caves tempted us. Farther down we reached at dusk a hamlet composed of three farms. The looks of the men who came out to examine us and inquired about our beasts and luggage were not very reassuring, but, though they were a rough lot, they treated us well in the end. In the evening, as we were seated with them near the fire, someone spoke about Lhasa, and, incidentally, uttered the dreaded word filings. Footnote. Besides being prompted by their natural kind-heartedness, Tibetans are always ready to direct a wayfarer because such an act is considered by them as highly meritorious and bearing good fruits in this life and the next one. On the contrary, to mislead any traveler is believed to have serious results. The unconsciousness of one who has done so will roam painfully in the Buddho, after its separation from the body, at death, being unable to find the road leading to a new rebirth. End of this footnote. They had heard about their existence from some of their relatives and friends, who had been to Lhasa or in China, but they had never seen any and none had ever visited their country. Yongden boasted of having met two of them in northern Tibet, but for my part one humbly confessed that I had never caught sight of any. 2 days later, from the summit of a sandy hill, we discovered, several thousand feet below us, a narrow glittering ribbon. It was the Jiamo Niu Chu, the upper course of the Salween. We had heard that somewhere in that region there was a place called Sawa, where the river could be crossed by a cable stretched from one bank to the other. But as passengers were very few on that out-of-phase path, the ferrymen lived far from the river and came there only when they were informed that a number of people meant to cross. We poor lone pilgrims might have remained for weeks in front of the rope but for the happy circumstance that a lama had performed some religious ceremonies at the house of the very farmer whose guests we had just been, and was returning to his monastery on the other side of the Jiamo Niu Chu, with a dozen of his followers. We waited only one day for his arrival in a pretty, sheltered place between picturesque red rocks. The weather was gloriously bright and the temperature mild. To cross a river hanging to a cable was not new to us. We had done it in other places. But at these other places, two different cables, one for each direction, were used to carry the passengers, who, starting from a point much higher than the landing place, glided swiftly, as if on a switchback. Here there was but a single cable fastened to poles fixed at the same level on either bank, and it sagged terrifyingly. Only the strongest of the countrymen dared to venture to cross by it unaided, for the climbing up from the bottom of the sag by the sheer strength of one's wrists was rather a feat. Most of them were therefore hauled up by ferrymen, as were the animals and baggage. When my turn came, a Tibetan girl and I were bound with rough straps, and tied together to a wooden hook that would glide on the leather cable. Dressed up in that way, a push sent us swinging in the vbid, like two pitiable puppets. In less than 1 minute we were down in the middle of the dip, and then, from the other bank, the ferrymen began their work. Each jerk they gave at the long towing rope caused us to dance in the air a most unpleasant kind of jig. This went on for a little while, then we felt a shock, heard a splash below us, and slipped back at full speed into the sagging dip of the cable. The towing rope had broken. The accident in itself did not endanger our lives. Men would come to fasten the rope that they were drawing out of the water. But giddiness might overcome us, suspended as we were 200 or 300 feet above the swift current. The way in which we were trussed up afforded security for a conscious passenger in an erect position whose hands had a strong grip on the strap under the hook. But this was not to be depended upon in the case of anyone who collapsed or dropped backward. My nerves are solid. I had no doubt I could stand there even for hours. But what of my companion? She was rather pale and looked with frightened eyes at the point where the strap to which we were suspended was fastened to the hook. What is the matter with you? I said. I have called my Tsawile armor out to protect us. You need not fear. With a slight motion of the head she indicated the hook. The strap is coming loose, she said, trembling.